arm and give it a squeeze. And I find that hand isn't numb after all, that I can feel the warmth of her against my palm, the brush of her ribcage as she takes a deeper breath.
"Jules,"
she mumbles, before her eyes even open, recognizing my touch.
"The hell? Think I'm gonna hurl."
She's got a concussion, of that I'm certain. I'm no doctor, but she was out for the better part of an hour, and the way she's trying to sit up and can't make her limbs work is all too familiar. People scoff at water polo, but they've never seen a guy take a blow to the temple and finish the point streaming blood, then desperately make for the edge of the pool so he can puke on the concrete.
"Here, let me,"
I whisper, forgetting Charlotte, but remembering my hands are free. I slide my arm under Mia's shoulders and help her sit up. They zip-tied her, too, and her fingers look unnaturally pink and puffy. She leans against me for support.
"Jules, what's going—"
But her dazed, unfocused eyes have wandered away from my face.
"Wait,"
she says, struggling to form the words.
"Am I am I seeing things?"
I follow her gaze, which is fixed on Charlotte. The woman standing right there, arms folded loosely, watching us with what looks like amusement. Like someone's aunt watching the antics of her little niece and nephew with bemused patience. If that aunt had a knife, was dressed in black ops military garb, and had a fleet of dozens of shuttles at her command.
"It's okay,"
I murmur, keeping my voice low, but not really caring if Charlotte hears.
"I'm going to handle this." "But..."
Mia's still staring, and after a few seconds of struggle, she blurts.
"Mink?"
Now I know she's concussed, and hallucinating.
"Mia,"
I say gently, trying to encourage her to look back at me.
"This is Charlotte. She's the one who recruited me, the one whose company backed my trip here."
Except, of course, they didn't, because Global Energy Solutions doesn't exist. But I can't explain that to myself yet, much less the concussed, half-conscious girl leaning against my shoulder.
"No,"
Mia says, blinking hard.
"No, that's Mink, my backer. She hired me, hired Liz and them. How is she? Are we still at the South Pole?"
But I'm staring at Charlotte again. She doesn't look confused. She doesn't look surprised. She doesn't look like anything. Except, perhaps, that patient aunt, waiting while her charges work torturously through a primary lesson, like one of those cardboard books that teach small children how to read.
"See Jane,"
my mind supplies, absurd and out of control.
"Mink. Mink is Charlotte."
My mind's spinning so much, I wonder if somehow Mia's concussion could be contagious.
"See Jane play." "We were hired by the same person?"
Mia's leaning harder against me, and somehow I know she wants to take my hand but can't. I wrap an arm around her instead. Charlotte, or whoever she is, sighs.
"When we were recruiting Mr. Addison here, he kept on asking whether it was really possible to make it to Gaia in secret, with the IA monitoring travel through the portal."
Mia leans in against me.
"So you gave him proof,"
she says quietly.
"See Jane jump." "We recruited a few scavengers to head for the planet," Charlotte says. "Pointed out that it was his own father's breakdown on live television that leaked all the info a scavenger would need, and that the record was already being contaminated. We took care to pick out those who had nobody of consequence to report them missing back home."
Mia goes stiff beside me, and all the breath leaves my body, as if I'd been punched in the gut. Nobody was ever coming to pick Mia up. And Mia didn't win her chance to come here because of her skill, as she thought. Charlotte, Mink, chose Mia because she was disposable, expendable. The woman's eyebrows lift. Think about it this way, Amelia. Everybody else we recruited is out there right now, waiting for a pickup that will never come. In your case, perhaps Mr. Addison will negotiate your way off the planet before all this is done. And you'll be able to go back to Evelyn, right? The precious sister. In this moment, I don't have to look at Mia's face to know what she's thinking. It's what I'm thinking. We haven't crossed a universe, traversed an alien planet, crawled through an ancient temple, and thrown ourselves into an unknown portal that could have obliterated us, just to let someone like this pull us apart. Charlotte unfolds her arm and steps toward the tent flap, making no move to untie Mia, and instead gesturing at me. Come with me, Mr. Addison. A voice is polite and remote, and, right now, more terrifying than a dozen armed and faceless soldiers. It's time to go to work. See Jane run. I need her, I blurt, not moving from Mia's side. She knows the glyphs as well as I do now. She knows their maths. I need her. A deep breath. And I need proof of life for the others, if you want me to do anything for you. My pilot and my soldier. My escape. Charlotte, Mink, Aunt Jane Doe, narrows her eyes a fraction and looks from my face to Mia's, lingering, considering. She heard which one of the three I named first. She heard the desperation in my voice. Her lips move, just the tiniest bit. It looks like she's smiling. Very well. Run, Jane. Run.
Chapter 19. Amelia. My head is spinning, aching. The ground feels uneven, not just because of the crunch of old snow beneath my boots, but because it keeps tilting crazily. My vision and inner ears fighting a doomed battle whose first casualty is my stomach. I don't know if it'd be more humiliating or satisfying to turn and hurl all over Mink's sleek uniform. I stay close to Jules, and every now and then he puts a hand out to steady me. They still haven't untied me. But even if I could use my hands for balance, I think I'd choose holding on to Jules instead. I'm not sure it was smart of him to demand I go with him. I'm not sure it was wise to let them know there's any connection between us at all besides coincidence. I'm not sure it was the best idea. But God, I'm so glad he did it. I could weep. The ship looms above us, even from a distance. It's more massive than I'd realized, with only the IA shuttles to use as reference. It could house hundreds, thousands of people. Or undying. Or, I don't even know anymore. It's sized for us the same way the temple was. The 50,000-year-old temple that had English engraved on it. I've never been what anyone could call honest. I dropped out of school illegally. I worked jobs that paid under the table. I outright stole once I made it to Chicago. But the depth, the complexity of the tangle of deceit binding us to Gaia makes my body start to shake. The undying, posing as a race who couldn't have known about humanity, creating an elaborate setup to get us to this spot? They knew us well. To know that a race for treasure would make us ignore our instincts, ignore our better natures, ignore any warnings just to get to it first and claim it for our own. Mink, or Charlotte, or whoever she is, letting me believe I was chosen to go to Gaia because of my skills, my quick thinking, my drive. The gut-wrenching blow of learning I was sent simply because the only person who'd notice I'd disappeared was a child in illegal bondage with no means of getting me back. God, Evie, I'm sorry. Even Jules. Jules, who lied to get me to help him. Jules, who told me the spiral-shaped temple being ignored by the other scavers would contain wealth beyond my wildest dreams. Jules, who let me follow him, knowing that it meant I was abandoning my sister. My eyes burn, and for a moment, I want to tear myself away from Jules's supportive arm. I want to run, anywhere, into the snow and ice, not caring if the soldiers shoot me in the back. Jules, who told me the truth as soon as he realized his lie was putting my life in danger. Jules, who gave up the chance to find his answers so that I wouldn't jump through that portal alone. Jules, who's lying even now to keep me alive, keep me safe, knowing that if he's found out, he'll likely be killed. I draw a quaking breath and blink back my tears, pressing my body close against Jules at my side. I feel his eyes on me, just for a second. This, at least, is true. The suns are just breaching the horizon, somewhere beyond the mountains. Their light paints a distant streak of clouds peach. And for a moment, it's so much like being home. Despite the alien ship. Despite the zip ties cutting into my wrists. Despite the frigid air burning the insides of my nose and steaming my breath. I want to stop and stare at it. Gaze at this sight one last time. In case it is the last time. And then we're in the shadow of the ship, and it's twilight once more. There's a door. After so long with only the background noises of the base being set up all around the ship, Mink's voice sounds like the crack of a whip. We've done a sonar sweep, but without knowing how stable the ship is, we're hesitant to use a larger charge. We do know there's a chamber beyond the door. Most likely some form of airlock. Great, replies Jules, voice flat. A few days ago, he'd have given his left arm to get even the tiniest scrap of information on a find like this. It's how much his priorities have changed, more than the tone in his voice, that leaves me shaken. I don't need to know any of this to translate your glyphs. Mink lets out a snort that puffs into the cold, then streams away behind us as we keep trudging toward the ship. You think it's just about translation? You and your dad don't have that skill cornered anymore, Mr. Addison. Hell, I can translate them myself reasonably accurately, given enough time. But whatever this locking mechanism is, there's more to it than the glyphs, which is where you come in. I catch, out of the corner of my eye, her head turning a little to look at me. Both of you. Fine. Jules reaches out to take my arm, almost absently tugging me upright. I hadn't noticed I'd begun to tilt. But I want to see a vid on someone's phone of Javier and Hansen saying they're alive and not being mistreated. I want proof of life if you want us to keep working. Mink's laugh is soft, and if I didn't know better, I'd think she was genuinely touched by his concern for them. Whatever you wish, she says, spreading her hands in an expansive gesture. In that case, I need my pack. Owl packs. Jules's fingers tighten around my arm a little. I'm trying to think. Remember what's still in there after Liz's gang got through ransacking them. Tell me what you need from your pack and I'll have it brought to you. Mink counters, cutting my ties so I can climb. With a squeak of her boots on the icy slush, she comes to a halt at the base of some scaffolding. When I look up, I see only the ship rising like a wall before us. Despite the dark, I find myself squinting, trying to focus. The hastily erected prefab scaffolding blocks end at a sleek round panel. The door, I'm guessing. It isn't that high off the ground, though my dizziness makes it seem like a climb twice as treacherous as the pit we scaled in the temple. Jules reaches the top first, and then reaches down to grab my hand and pull me up after him. He hesitates there, my hand in his, as though he'd like to pull me in against him. I wish we could stop, breathe, figure out what it means that the woman who hired him and the one who hired me are the same person. Figure out what the languages we saw in the temple meant. What it means that this ship is here at all. How it connects to the Nautilus warnings. I wish we could be alone again. But Mink, Charlotte, whoever she is standing at the base of the scaffold, watching us. So when Jules tightens his hand around mine, I shake my head, ignoring the way my concussion makes my vision dance in response. Not here. Not when it's ammunition for them. Don't show them your cards. Jules understands. He lets go of my hand with a shaky breath out and turns his attention to Mink, listing what we need from our packs. He tries for as many of our possessions as he can. I lean my head against the pole beside me while they fetch our gear, along with a video of a wary Javier and Hansen telling the camera they're still alive. And then, Jules and I both look up at the doorway. It's a large round thing with glyphs circling it and minute cracks radiating outward from its center. For half a second, I wonder if the IA actually did try to blast their way in, when I realize they're not cracks. They're seams. The doors meant to iris outward, like the door we short-circuited in the temple with my phone. As one, Jules and I both glance down and to the right, and there it is. A small, barely noticeable indentation at chest level, gleaming with crystalline circuitry. I have to fight the insane urge to laugh, hysteria trying to bubble up inside me. All this buildup, all the drama of Mink's strong-arming, all the posturing and the threats, spoken and unspoken. And it's not even a puzzle. It's a simple lock. One we've known how to pick since before we even discovered the ship. It makes perfect sense. If the Undying wanted to be sure that whoever found this ship was worthy of their prize, then they'd use a puzzle said worthy ones had already solved when we were approaching the portal through their temple, passing their tests. I draw breath, but Jules lifts a hand abruptly, gesturing above us. I pause. There are glyphs here, he says, conversational, gesturing to the glyphs circling the doorway. Mink's close enough that she'll hear every word, and we can't risk whispering to each other. I'll need to translate them and compare them against the notes I have from the carvings in the temple. Right. My poor brain is struggling to keep up. But whatever he's doing, I'm in. I'll get your journal. It's among the things he asked for, to help with deciphering the way through the door. I crouch down to retrieve it from the bag, and find my multi-tool in there as well. He must have put it on the list he gave them while I was zoned out. No need for Mink to find out about the modifications I made to it. She'd never have handed it over if she'd known how truly useful it is. I settle it in my hand for a moment. The grip blessedly familiar. But when I look down, Mink's staring straight at me. I can't slide it into my pocket while she's watching. So I reluctantly leave it where it is. Okay. Jules takes a long breath, a dramatically weary sigh. Easy there, Macbeth. We're not on stage. So, this one here. He's dictating slowly, translating them one by one, taking his sweet time and double-checking what I'm writing. Jules, who I've seen read the Undying script like it's English, like he grew up reading it, which, come to think of it, he did. Then my struggling brain catches up. He's stalling for time. Mink, or Charlotte, or whoever the hell she is, doesn't know how easily he can read the glyphs. And she doesn't know we already have the answer to opening this door. But the moment we do open it, Jules and I become just that much less important, less useful, less worth carrying. Fighting the urge to look down and see if Mink's watching, I flip back to some of his earlier translations, where hopefully they won't look if they decide to double-check his work here. We can't stall forever, I write, trying to stop my hand shaking through sheer willpower. Jules is still translating, droning on in a voice that makes me want to tear my hair out. Good Lord, he must have had some boring-ass teachers in his life to learn that. He glances down. Yes, good. That looks right. This next one. Way too many of them to fight. I'm cramming the words in the margins of a sketch of the Nautilus, some unreadable glyphs copied down next to it. And we can't run. Even if we get away, we'll die with no food, water, O2. Jules nods, looking down at the page, his eyes grim. But there's hope there, too. We're still together. And right now, in this moment, they need Jules, which gives us power, however tiny. I feel that hope kindle a spark somewhere inside me, too. This grouping of glyphs here has something to do with an exchange, I think. A trade, a deal? Of course, that's if you trust the glyphs. There were plenty fake messages in that temple that were just there to trick us. None of the glyphed instructions in the temple were false. We survived their traps. And though we don't know which faction to trust, the Undying who made the broadcast to get us here, or the Undying who left the Fibonacci spirals to warn us away, Jules isn't talking about the Undying right now. Not really. Definitely not, I write, flipping a page and turning the journal sideways so I can write along the border of a sketch of one of the puzzles. I wouldn't trust these people as far as I could throw this ship. Jules snorts and turns it into a cough. And when I look down, Mink's frowning up at us. Can we get some water? I call down. It's a long shot. And I'm not surprised when, instead of leaving her post at the foot of the scaffold, she just talks into a communications unit tucked into her collar. Jules scrubs his hand over his face, resolutely keeping his eyes on the glyphs. I'm pretty sure they say something like, "Please use caution when opening the doors." But he's not budging. This one's new. I'm stuck. I make a show of looking up, staring in the direction he's staring, though my mind's racing, as I'm sure his is too. There has to be a way out of this. There's always a way out. but sitting on a rickety scaffold at the south pole of a planet on the opposite side of the universe from home, surrounded by some of the best-trained soldiers in the world. For once, I'm drawing a complete blank. I've accidentally kept the pen pressed to the journal page, and there's a blot of ink there when I finally twitch my hand away. I turn the page. "Jules," I write, letting the pen dwell on the curves and lines of the letters, letting my hand memorize the pattern of his name, letting my eyes drink it in. I'm scared. When I look up, his eyes are on mine and not the journal. And he swallows hard, the hand resting against the side of the ship curling until it's a fist. He nods, wordless. And his eyes say, "Me too." I turn another page and find a sketch there. But it's not of a series of glyphs, or an architectural anomaly, or a diagram mapping the floor tiles. It's me. The face is stylized, not quite realistic, but precise and instantly recognizable. I'm looking down, in profile, my hair falling forward, and I look sad. So sad, I almost feel it for real. The pen strokes emphasize and darken certain parts of my face. The angularity of my jaw, like I'm clenching it, determined. My eyes, large, reflecting the light he must have drawn this by. The freckles on my cheek, in a pattern I didn't know I recognized from the mirror until now, seeing it here, captured in perfect detail. And my lips. His pen lingered there. He turned the slight blot of ink into a shadow, smoothed it out, went over them again and again. The drawing is beautiful. I've never been beautiful before. But I am here, on this page. In this picture that looks exactly like me. I look up to find Jules's eyes on the journal, fixed there, not meeting mine. His lips are tight, and I know under any other circumstances this moment would be a violation. I've never tried to sneak a peek at his journal. Not least because I'm pretty sure I wouldn't understand half the stuff in there. And that must be why he felt it was safe to draw this. This declaration. I swallow hard and fight against the tears burning my eyes. I grip the pen again, and as a drop patters against the page, blurring part of my hair, I write, "Me too." There's just enough time to look up again, for him to look at the journal and then at me. A universe in those eyes. A language that doesn't need translating. There's just enough time to remember the moment before I leapt through the portal. When his arms tightened around me. When I forgot where I was, and what I was doing, and who I was, and what I was. There's just enough time for the corner of his mouth, his perfect mouth, to lift. There's not enough time at all. The scaffold gives a sudden jerk, and I gasp as I reach out for one of the supports. Minks on her way up, the added weight making the whole thing groan and sway. Without thinking, I scrub my sleeve across my eyes and flip pages with my other hand, back to the end of the journal, writing down the few glyphs I have learned over the past few days, the few I can recognize from up there, so it looks like we've done something. I stop just as she reaches the top. "Water?" I ask, my voice sounding remarkably bright and normal, for feeling like there's a howling gale inside my chest. Mink's frowning. She unslings a canteen from over her shoulder and tosses it at Jules. Then reaches down to pull the journal from my hands. I cast a brief, panicked look at Jules, whose own visible panic is enough to bring me back to myself. I gesture at him to drink. Who knows when we'll get water again? And rise up on my knees. This is all super weird, Mink, I say, trying to emulate Jules's tone when he's lost in thought, danger forgotten in favor of academic zeal. We can't make sense of these phrases. They're all bullshit. Mink's voice is hard. Well, you haven't done anything. She looks up from the journal page, eyes going from my face to Jules's and back again. You honestly think, after all this, that I'm stupid? Ordinarily, I'd point out that we've got all the time in the universe, that you can stall as long as you like. But there's no cavalry coming, and you're going to get pretty cold eventually. But I'm getting impatient. Open the door, Mr. Addison. Jules swallows his mouthful of water and steels himself. I'm trying, Charlotte. I just haven't seen. Try harder. Look, I'm doing my best. Jules's voice cracks, despite the water. And my heart gives a little aching ping in response. Mink watches him for a moment, lips together, eyes thoughtful. Then, before either of us can react, she reaches down and grabs my upper arm and drags me to my feet. She's absurdly strong for someone her size, like her whole body is muscle. I reach out for one of the scaffold supports out of instinct, though even if she shoved me off, it's not high enough that the fall would kill me. Maybe break something, if I landed funny, but probably not. I've got practice falling. I know how to land. My mind's calculating all of this in a fraction of a second, because in the next second, it all drains away. Her gun's out, and she's pressing it to my temple. Open the door, Mr. Addison. Jules's face goes ashen. He's staring at me, and his heart's in his eyes. And even if it hadn't been on that page, I'd see it now as clearly as the sunrise I didn't want to leave behind, as clearly as the unfamiliar stars overhead the last time he had his arms around me. Mink smiles and cocks the gun. Open the door.
Chapter 20. Jules. I'm stumbling along in a fog. I should be fascinated, riveted. I should be stopping at every intersection, every doorway, every crack in the wall. I should be reading every scrap of text I can find. I should be back in Valencia, discovering wonder all over again. I'm walking through the corridor of an alien ship, tens of thousands of years old. I'm seeing something no human has ever seen before, walking where no human has ever stepped. At the wildest heights of fancy as a child, I never dreamed of this. Open the door, Mr. Addison. I should be lost in the stories this place is waiting to tell me. Instead, I'm just lost. I need a phone. In theory, Charlotte's got me out in front, so that if there are traps waiting for us here, like there were in the temples, I'll either see them or get hit by them first. I'm holding the bag containing my journal in front of me like a shield, but somehow I know there aren't any traps. This is what the broadcast wanted us to find, or else this ship is what its hidden message told us to fear. Me, Charlotte, and a half dozen of her operatives, helmeted and faceless, their torch beams crisscrossing the air. Air that's been still since the last undying stepped off this ship and closed its doors. Until I opened them. Just trust me. It's a lock, that's all. Don't shoot her. Yes, okay? I was stalling. We're bloody well scared. What else would we be? But I'll open it. A phone. The conductivity, it's a...
a key. Please, I'm telling the truth.
The door opened on an octagonal room that could have been an airlock. Beyond it, corridors branched out in a fan. I chose one at random. And now we're walking, exploring, doing what I've longed to do since I was a child. My father first told me tales of ancient beings who left us stories to solve and lessons to learn. And I'm at gunpoint. And I'm alone.
Wait! Wait! I did what you said! What are you doing with her? I need her with me. She's my maths. I did as you asked. I did!
The corridors all look alike. Crystalline streaks running through the metallic stone like frozen rivers. Like the whole ship is made of ice. Like it might melt once the suns rise a little higher in the sky. Outside I can hear charges detonating as the IA soldiers clear the ice away from the hull. A part of my brain is firing off questions, 100 a minute. For what purpose did the Undying bring us here, to this ship? Why is this ship so important? What did they intend us to do with it? And the heaviest question of all of them, who left the Nautilus warnings, and what danger were we meant to escape? What were their intentions, these aliens who knew how to deceive us so perfectly? And what were the intentions of the ones who left us the warning about this gift? Were they members of the Undying too? What did they know that I can't guess? But I can't focus on my endless questions, because there's just one that's living at the forefront of my mind, taking up all available real estate. How do I keep Mia safe? I can still hear Javier's voice ringing in my ears, talking about how disposable we were after they killed Liz. "They'd need a hell of a reason to keep you around," he said. "So I need to show them a hell of a reason. I know I should be trying to memorize the ship's layout. I know I should be doing something. Stalling them, ingratiating myself, finding weak points among Charlotte's soldiers. Doing what Mia would do. What Mia..." My ears are ringing, echoing. My memory won't let it go. The soft click of the hammer releasing as Charlotte slowly lowered the gun and tucked it into her holster again. As my heart started beating again. I need her. The last I saw of Mia was a flash of her white face as they shoved me into the ship. I saw her eyes, large and dark in the low light, saw the faded pink in her hair glinting as the sunrise on the other side of the ship bloomed, saw her open her mouth to call out for me, and then she was gone. Charlotte's voice echoing in my head. "Don't worry, she'll be alive. Kill her, and we lose our power over you. Hurt her, though." Her face serene, almost whimsical, as she lifted a shoulder. I have to focus. I do my job. Mia lives. Right now, that's all I know. Right now, that's all that matters.
Chapter 21. Amelia. The hours creep by, and I'm left cuffed to the scaffolding by the entrance to the ship. I yank at my bindings a few times, and eventually a soldier just points his gun at my face until I stop. Message received. I'm so used to the commotion passing me by that I don't notice when one of the uniformed soldiers stops in front of me until he grasps my wrists to untie me from the scaffolding. The motion sends twin jolts of pain up my arms into my shoulders, and I let out a hoarse sound of protest, or surprise, or exhaustion. I'm not even sure. He ignores it, double-checking that my hands are still tied securely to each other. The IA soldier says nothing, choosing to give his orders in the form of brute force. He hauls me to my feet by my bound hands. then shoves me through the ship's entrance and down one of the multiple corridors that branch off just inside. My mind is blank. All those years, dodging the cops and talking my way out of scrapes, and I've got nothing. Any second now, I'm going to see Javier and Hansen, dead, stashed wherever they stash the people they don't need anymore. Any second now, I'm going to join them. And I've got nothing. They lead me in a circuitous route that takes me through the long corridors. I lose all track of where we are, though the hallways are far from featureless, marked by the same strange metallic stone and crystalline circuitry we saw in the temple. I suppose I ought to be glad that they're leading me into the ship rather than taking me back outside. If they were planning on killing me, surely they'd do it out in the snow, and not where my brains would get splattered all over their precious artifacts. They bring me to a door not unlike those in the temple, and pry it open with a crowbar and a screech of scraping rock. They cut the ties binding my hands and toss me inside. The door slams closed behind me, the air battering against my ears and making my abused head spin all the more. You okay? I whirl around at the voice and immediately regret the sudden movement, groaning and trying to feel at the scabbed over spot where they hit me. My arms are like wet noodles. My hands numb and tingling. I blink and find Javier there, a few steps away. He's got one hand outstretched, like he's ready to catch me. Like I look ready to drop where I stand. I suck in a deep breath and steel myself, blinking again and scanning the room. Both Javier and Hansen are there, unbound but stripped of their gear, like me. Not dead, I think, with a surprising depth of relief, given that a day ago we were running for our lives from these guys. The way our luck's been going, I was pretty sure they'd been shot the minute they were done telling the camera they were alive. I'm okay. I pause. Well, I mean, as okay as I can be. Our cell is a small, pod-like room as featureless as the snowy plain outside, lit by a simple LED lamp, the one from Javier's gear. The door has a small indentation next to it. Not like the one Jules figured out how to crack, though, even if we did have something conductive. This one's a bit bigger than a hand, but pushing against it does nothing. If it were some summer sci-fi blockbuster, the door would go whooshing open at our touch. But apparently the Undying never watched those movies. Or else the batteries are dead. Home sweet home, Javier says as I look around. Your boy Jules came through here early on. Apparently, said there was nothing worth seeing in here. His mouth quirks. Guess they're counting on the fact that it'd be a lot harder to escape from stone walls than canvas ones. I try to pry at the door's edge. But even after both Javier and Hansen add their strength to mine, the stone doesn't budge. It's impossible to get much purchase on it without something to pry with. What I wouldn't give for my multi-tool right now. Well, at least they seem to think your boy's as important as everyone else does. Javier drops down onto the floor, putting his back against the wall. Pretty sure we'd be dead if they didn't. I hope you're right. My suspicious mind can come up with half a dozen reasons they might keep us alive that have nothing to do with Jules. Bait for more traps, lab rats to send down unexplored corridors. But my money, if I had any, is on Jules. Hansen's looking between the two of us, face blank, before he suddenly blurts, "How the hell are you two so freaking calm? I mean, what the hell, guys? We're screwed. We're so goddamn screwed, I can't even... Well, what do you want?" I snap. My temper is frayed beyond tatters as it is. And he's not helping by echoing the thoughts I'm not willing to speak aloud. Us to burst into tears and wail and rend our clothes and beat ourselves to death against a door? Hansen scowls at me. At least pissed off is better than panicking. "This is all your fault anyway." "My fault?" I sputter. "You're the ones who ran us ragged. No one made you follow us through that portal." "She did. Biz made me." "Well, she's dead." The words seem to echo despite the confines of the room, spilling into a sudden silence as thick and impenetrable as the stone door entombing us. I'm regretting them already for more than one reason. Shouting makes my head throb. I try to take a calming breath. "Look, I'm sorry. I just..." "She's right." Javier stays on the floor, though he lifts his head to glance between me and Hansen. "Lise is dead. She's gone. We have to assume that Jules is too, as far as we're concerned. Whatever they're using him for, he doesn't involve us. His identity may have kept us alive this far, but it's on us to get out of here on our own." "I'm not going anywhere without Jules." The words come out automatically, before I even register the thought. I ought to be surprised at the steel in my voice. And Liz's remaining men clearly are. But I remember that drawing. And I remember that little smile when I wrote, "Me too." And I'm not surprised at all. I clear my throat. "I'm not leaving him here." Javier's brows lift, but he doesn't protest. "One step at a time," he says instead. "We're not going anywhere inside this room, but they'll have to open it eventually. There's no food slot or anything. This wasn't built as a prison. They'll have to open it to feed us, take us to the bathroom, that sort of thing. Now, when they brought me and Hansen to the cell, they had 6 guys on us. But I noticed only one with you." His eyes are on me, and I glance away at Hansen, who's suddenly watching me with renewed interest. "Yeah, but one guy with an automatic rifle and body armor and a crapload of training." I take a step back. I climb. I sneak. I scramble. I don't fight. Besides, I'm like half their size. I wouldn't stand a chance. You'd do better against 6 dudes. Javier grins, shaking his head. "You're quick, and that counts for a lot more than size or strength. I noticed you had a gun on them before they had one on you, when they took us to camp." "Yeah, with the stupid safety on," I mutter. "Well, I doubt these guys leave their safeties on. Is that supposed to be a comfort to me?" Javier gets slowly to his feet. "You're right that these guys are well-trained. But I don't think their training really involved what to do with prisoners. One of the ones guarding me actually had his gun pressed against my back while we were walking. A dumb mistake. I can show you what to do. How to get the jump on them." "Yeah, and send me home sporting some lovely new piercings in the shape of bullet holes." "Me and Hansen, we're bros, clearly trained. They watch us too carefully. Put too many guys on us. But you're small, you're quick, and most importantly, they're underestimating you just as much as Lise did." I can feel my stomach shriveling. Wait, you're serious? You want me to overpower a fully armed, fully trained guard twice my size without so much as a freaking spoon for a weapon? Javier beckons to Hansen, who groans as though he knows what's coming. Watch me, Javier says, and pretend Hansen hears your guard.
I'm out.
Hansen's on the floor and rolls over until he's face down on the stone.
Somebody else be the guard for a while.
Javier ignores him, grinning at me. Not bad. You're getting faster. I'm gazing down at Hansen, but more because I don't want to look at Javier, and the hope and desperation there in his face. He's so certain I'm our best chance of getting out of here. I wish I could feel so sure. Yeah, but we're pretending his arm's a gun. Arms don't shoot very fast. Pretty sure a real gun's gonna go off before I'm out of the way. Javier shrugs. Maybe. I stare at him. Okay, dude, you've got to get better at lying. There's no point in lying. He's somber now, grin fading away. But I also wouldn't be suggesting this if I didn't think it stood a good chance of working. If one of us tries something and fails, it'll be the only excuse they need to shoot the rest of us to avoid any more trouble. We're in this together now. His eyes soften a bit, and I remember what he let slip before we were captured. He's got kids of his own somewhere back on Earth. You can do this. We've been through the movements so many times, it's like instant replay in my mind. With the guard close enough for the barrel of his gun to press into my back, I can twist, sending the gun to the right as I dodge left, which throws the guard off balance and lets me charge my shoulder into his ribcage and knock him down. Then, I can get my foot on the gun barrel, pressing it down against the guard with all my weight so he can't possibly lift it up to aim it at me again. But all of that, that's just step one. We let Hansen have a rest so he can sit at the far edge of the room and nurse his bruises and glare at me. My heart's pounding from the exercise and from the adrenaline. I lean back against the wall, letting it take my weight. You can do it, Javier repeats quietly. The only question is, will you? I swallow, lifting my head from the stone wall behind me so I can look at him. What? It's one thing to hold a gun, even aim it at someone. It's something else to pull the trigger, especially when you're standing so close. Each one of our practice sessions with Hansen has ended with my foot on his arm, pressing his outstretched finger against his throat, and Javier saying, "Bang! Okay, good job. Now, next time." But it won't be Javier saying bang. It won't be someone's arm. And it won't be Hansen getting back up afterward, groaning about his bruises and rubbing his chest. It won't be me grinning and breathing hard and high-fiving my coach. It'll be an ear-shattering explosion and a jolt that makes my leg go numb, and the top of a guy's skull splattered against the floor. It'll be me killing someone. I haven't stopped feeling nauseous since I woke up, since I saw Mink standing in front of us in an IA Black Ops uniform. But I'm not so sure it's the concussion anymore. I shut my eyes, hoping that it'll cut the dizziness. But instead, it leaves me feeling like I'm in a dense fog that only grows thicker with every passing moment. Before I can answer, before I even know what the answer is, a sound outside makes all three of our heads snap toward the exit. Footsteps. The clang of metal on metal. Then the faint creak of a crowbar settling into the seam of the door. I tear my eyes away to find Javier looking at me. I exhale, long and slow. I guess we'll find out, I whisper, and turn toward the door.
Chapter 22. Jules. I've been climbing stairs for hours. The inside of this place is a maze the size of our biggest skyscrapers back home. And without any power for transport between levels, I'm reduced to climbing up and down what I assume are emergency stairways. I have two guards trailing after me, and we're not the only team exploring. We cross paths with half a dozen other groups, the corridors echoing with booted footsteps and the occasional burst of static from comms radios. Twice I catch a glimpse of Charlotte, heading up one of the exploratory teams, and her gaze swings over toward me, eyes narrowed, speculative. This must be the first time she's personally entered an undying structure. Does she find it as unnerving as we did, our first day in the temple, when Mia asked me why it seemed so like our own ruins? And what would she think if she knew what we'd seen before we jumped through the portal? The languages of Earth's past and present, the Nautilus warnings. Pergite si audetis. Onward, if you dare. But onward to what? I force my thoughts back to the hallway ahead of me. I don't know how much time I have to come up with something she deems useful before she starts making good on her threats against Mia. I'm following my instincts, absorbing what I can from the glyphs, though there are dozens I've never seen before. It's like one giant puzzle to solve, and it turns out I was training for it by surviving the temple. My legs are groaning and protesting as I force myself up yet another staircase, trying not to think about the descent that's yet to come. I pause on the landing to brace my hands on my knees, casting a resentful look at the closed doors of what I'm pretty sure is a powerless elevator, then straighten to force myself onward.
Where are we going?
The soldier behind me is as sick of climbing as I am.
That way,
I say, trying to make my tone confident, to make up for the lack of specificity. I don't want him reporting back that I seem unsure.
And what's that way?
The other asks, taking a swallow from her canteen, then handing it across to the first guy, who follows suit, and then hands it to me.
Maybe the ship's bridge, or something like a control room, I say. Maybe something else to do with the ship's hierarchy. It's important, that's all I can tell you.
I trace a line of silvery glyphs. They indicate power and control, and the concept of change, which I speculate might mean something to do with making adjustments, perhaps to the engines or the power source of the ship. That power source has to be what the IA's after. They want the tech that could power a ship this big, and damn the lessons that could be learned by exploring it properly. They couldn't create a future for humanity with their mission to Alpha Centauri. Now they're hoping this ship, and the tech it holds, will be Earth's salvation. That it will do for the world what the first power cell did for Los Angeles. The IA wants this to be the treasure the Undying promised us in their broadcast. They need it to be the answer. But the words in that broadcast echo over and over in my mind, sounding so changed now that I know what I know. Unlocking the door may lead to salvation or doom. Whatever the Undying's ultimate plan, at least one of them took great risk in trying to warn the target of their deceptions. To warn us. And I'm not about to ignore that warning. Not anymore. The corridor leads to a small room, and the beam of my head torch swings across its interior. On the far side is what I think must be a control panel, backed by a reflective wall. My escort checks there's no other way out of the room, and then settles down in the hallway outside to wait. The controls sit at about waist height, a long bench covered in carved grooves and depressions. Perhaps if it were powered, you could drag your fingertips along it like a sensor pad. I already know from the temple that this strange, stone-like material can sense changes in pressure. I glance at my reflection in the reflective wall. My curls are wilder than usual. I look wrecked. Then realize a moment.